Welcome to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me is my co-host and mother, Caroline Kilborn.
Hello, everyone. We have an interesting book today. It's a book of poetry, and the author is Maggie Smith. And Maggie is, the award-winning author of Good Bones, The Well Speaks of Its Own Poison, Lamp of the Body, and a national bestseller, Keep Moving, Notes on Loss, Creativity, and Change. A 2011 recipient of the Creative Writing Fellowship from the National Endowment for the Arts, Smith has also received several individual excellence awards from the Ohio Arts Council, two Academy of American Poets Prizes, a Pushcart Prize, and fellowships from the Sustainable Arts Foundation and the Virginia Center for the Creative Arts. Obviously, she has been widely published, appearing in the New York Times, The New Yorker, The Paris Review, and the Best American Poetry, and more. Oh, that's quite a lineup there.
Quite a resume.
Yes, I should say.
Welcome to Writer's Voices, Maggie.
Thank you so much for having me. It's good to be here.
Now, Goldenrod is a lovely collection of poetry, and this is your fourth. Is this your fourth published poetry collection?
Yes, it's my fifth book, fourth book of poems. That's right.
And tell us a little bit about the other book that wasn't a book of poems.
Oh, Keep Moving.
Yeah.
So Keep Moving, Notes on Loss, Creativity, and Change is a collection of essays and quotes that came out in 2020. That's the sort of outlier book for me. I've been publishing books of poems for years. And then in the middle of my divorce, I started writing these little pep talks to myself and posting them on my social media. And so those are the quotes in the book. And then I wrote several essays, personal essays, for the book. And they're all sort of woven together in something that's not quite like anything I've picked up at the bookstore before. It's sort of its own genre, I think.
So is it like, it says it's a journal. So is it, there's room for people to write their own things in it?
So the book that came out in 2020 is a book. It's essays and quotes.
Okay.
There is, in fact, a guided journal that's a companion book to Keep Moving. Keep Moving, the journal, is coming out in October.
Okay.
So that will have some of the familiar quotes to people, some new quotes, and then, yes, writing prompts and questions and space for readers to sort of work through some of their own personal experiences rather than just reading about mine.
So we love quotes, don't we, Mom?
Mm-hmm.
So what can you give us, like, one of your favorite quotes from the book?
Sure. I just opened it and I'll read this one. You are not betraying your grief by feeling joy. You are not being graded, and you do not receive extra credit for being miserable 100% of the time. Find pockets of relief, even happiness, where and when you can. Keep moving.
Mm-hmm. Very good.
Now, that's a very, very apt quote for the world today. In Goldenrod, you deal with something with the kind of the condition of the world, and also in some of the essays you've recently had published in the New York Times and the Washington Post, and I think in some ways that one of the reasons I really enjoyed your book was there's so much, it's hard to feel joy even when good things are happening to me personally, because there's so much unhappiness in the world right now, and it feels like, you know, I've lived quite a few decades, and it feels like it hasn't been this way before in my lifetime.
Yeah,
no,
yeah.
It hasn't, no.
It has been a hard time to lean into joy, I think, because we feel almost a little guilty.
Yeah.
Or when people ask us how we're doing, if your gut instinct is, oh, actually, I'm having a great day, you feel a little bad saying that when you've just scrolled your phone and you know what's happening, not just elsewhere in the world, but in your own community. There's so much suffering that we've been witness to, not just over the past year and a half, but, you know, it just seems like it sort of just keeps on coming. And yet, I think that's one of the reasons why we really need to embrace joy. I have a pennant hanging in my front windows of my house that has a line from a Toy Derricott poem on it. And that line is, joy is an act of resistance. And this notion that as we see what the suffering and we see what's wrong and we don't turn a blind eye to it, but we also insist on embracing the things in our lives that are going well and right.
That is actually something I needed to hear. Thank you.
I'm glad.
Yeah. Yeah. So, Maggie, your press kit says that you gained star status in 2016 when your viral poem, with your viral poem, Good Bones. So what was that poem about, and why do you think that went viral?
So Good Bones is a relatively brief poem. It's 17 lines, and I wrote it in a coffee shop in my neighborhood in the summer of 2015. And it's really a poem about having young children, in my case, and not knowing how to explain this world to them with all of its beauty, but also all of its danger and terror, frankly. And so I sent it off to journals, and the journal that ended up publishing it, an online journal called Waxwing, published it 1 week in June 2016, and it happened to be the same week that the Pulse nightclub shooting happened in Orlando, and the same week that Joe Cox, a member of parliament and a mother herself, was murdered in England. And so the poem went viral really because people were suffering and hurting and trying to make sense of these senseless crimes and looking for comfort. And I think the poem recognized the horror, but also offered them a bit of comfort. So now I kind of joke that poem is a disaster barometer, because whenever it's shared widely, as it was after the presidential election, as it was after really any natural disaster or bombing or school shooting or you name it, it's usually because something, you know, bad has happened in the world and people are sharing it as a way of seeking comfort. And so if my social media starts to pick up because of Good Bones, my first instinct is to go and find out what happened in the world, because I know that if it's being shared widely, something has happened. It really is a disaster barometer for me.
Oh, wow.
Well, you don't have to look very far to find things happening, do you, in today's world?
No. One does not need to look far. But, I mean, it's true. I was in New York City for a reading once, and I went back to my hotel room, and my Twitter mentions were just going crazy. And so the first thing I did was, you know, I just went to CNN, and it was the night of the Ariana Grande concert bombing in Manchester. And that has really been my experience, is whenever my social media picks up, it is always something that has happened in the world. And so I usually don't know what it is. I just know that something has happened. And so it's been a kind of complicated thing for me to have this poem in the world, and to have created something that tends to be shared widely when the worst things have occurred.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
I mean,
strange legacy as a poet.
It is, and it's hard to even wrap my mind around it. It's like you would feel glad that you're able to, that you put something out there that brings people comfort, but it's also like you're becoming better known as a result of the tragedies in the world. So
that's
how,
right. That is what, it's a very complicated, I have a very complicated relationship with this poem. It feels almost like public domain work to me. It feels almost like it's not mine anymore. Of all the things I've written and published, I feel very differently about this poem than I do about any others. And it really just feels like it sort of belongs to the world and is less mine than anything else I've ever made.
Well, that's a good way to look at it, I think. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and that's why we write, that's why we make things. I mean, I do write poems for myself primarily. They're sort of the way I work things out for myself on paper. But it's like, it's what a gift that it gets to go and live its own life and be translated into languages I'll never read and travel to readers and places I will never visit. I mean, it really is having a life of its own. And so despite the fact that it's shared most often during tragedies, it's lovely to see it out there kind of doing its job in the world.
It's interesting you talk. You mentioned that it's translated into languages you will never read. Translating poetry is a really tricky thing, isn't it?
It is. I mean, in some ways, all poetry is translation because we're trying to take what's in our brains and put it into words. And sometimes that translation happens quite naturally, and other times I just can't quite find the word, even though I speak English. But yes, I mean, even Keep Moving, my book of essays and quotes, has been translated into several languages. And I'm looking right now in my office at the Korean edition right now, and I can't read any of it. I just have to trust that the gist of what I wrote is in there.
Yeah, but it's not, I mean, languages don't always have equivalent words. And if they do, the rhythm can be disrupted.
That's true.
How in the world can you ever really get it to be it's not going to be the same in another language.
No, it's not. It's not the same. And in fact, I worked with several translators translating Good Bones into other languages. And so I worked directly, for example, with a translator who was working in Bengali. And because Good Bones is an idiom, right, it doesn't mean happy skeleton. So putting the word Good Bones into a poem in Bengali didn't make any sense because the meaning does not translate into that language. So actually, there are plenty of translations of that poem that do not have the word good or bones in the poem or in the title because the idiom didn't translate.
Right.
So we actually had to choose something more along the lines of strong foundation to mean what we were going for. So yes, it's really interesting to think that even the title of the poem can't remain because it frankly wouldn't make any sense outside of English.
Exactly. And then it makes you wonder when we read things that were originally written in another language, how true to the poet's intention they really are.
Yeah. What are we missing?
What are we missing?
Like, what little nuances are we missing? That's right.
Yeah. You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Maggie Smith, who's a poet, and her current collection of poems is titled Goldenrod. I'd like you to read for us today, and maybe we'll just spread it out sort of over the interview. And so do you have a poem you'd like to start with?
Sure. Maybe I'll start with the title poem.
That sounds perfect.
Like a sensible beginning.
Yes.
Okay. This is Goldenrod. I'm no botanist. If you're the color of sulfur and growing at the roadside, you're goldenrod. You don't care what I call you, whatever you were born as. You don't know your own name. But driving near Peoria, the sky pink-orange, the sun bobbing at the horizon, I see everything is what it is exactly. in spite of the words I use. Black cows, barns falling in on themselves. You, dear flowers born with a highway view, forgive me if I've mistaken you. Goldenrod, whatever your name is, you are with your own kind. Look, the meadow is a mirror, full of you, your reflection repeating. Whatever you are, I see you, wild yellow, and I would let you name me.
So what is it about goldenrod that has such resonance for you?
Well, the poem really was just a poem of happenstance, as most poems are. I mean, they usually begin just with a simple observation, you know, me looking out my window or taking a walk and looking up or hearing something. Or in the case of this poem, driving down the highway and looking out at this field of flowers and thinking I recognize them and then thinking, well, on second thought, I actually have no idea what those things are called. And what does that mean?
And really, they don't
how do
care.
We know what we know? And they actually don't care because they don't know me either. I'm just passing through. And so thinking a little bit about the, you know, the power of language and the power of naming, and also the limits and the limitations of language and the limitations of naming, and how things are what they are, regardless of what we may or may not call them. And so when I was thinking about what I wanted the title of this book to be, I had all of these poem titles to choose from. And that's usually how I do it. I go through the table of contents and I look at all of the poems I've gathered together to be in conversation in a book. And I think, okay, so which one of these poem titles could speak for the whole? Which one kind of has enough metaphorical weight to it that it can speak for the whole? And it wasn't going to be a poem called Walking the Dog or Poor Sheep or, you know, December 18th, 2008. There are some poem titles that just don't really work to really sort of encompass or represent the whole collection. And there were a few that kind of made the short list, and Goldenrod was one of them. And when I found out that the scientific name Solidago means to make whole or to heal, and that the plant has been used for its healing properties, which is not something I knew driving down the road and noticing them, that gave me a feeling of, oh, actually, I like that gesture, because so many of these poems were really written through difficulties, both, you know, culturally and politically and personally. And the sort of gesture toward these flowers with a healing property, I liked that. So that's why Goldenrod won over the other options.
For me, Goldenrod, when I hear Goldenrod, I think of my father, who died at very young, age 49, so many, many years ago. And because, but it was because he was allergic to goldenrod.
No.
And he had terrible allergies.
Yeah.
And so whenever I see goldenrod, I think of my dad and his allergies. Do you remember that, Mom?
Oh, yeah, I sure do, because I had to mow the yard.
I didn't know that.
The truth comes out.
Yeah. California.
Someone who hates mowing the lawn, I sympathize.
Yeah. Wow.
Well, yeah, you know what? There's in Iowa, there are several beautiful yellow flowers that you can see whole fields of them, and they're small. And then there's some that are right along the road, and they're small, but they're just gorgeous. And yellow seems to be the favorite color for the flowers of summer. I don't know why, but it just is.
Mm-hmm. For wildflowers, especially. It's true.
Oh, yeah. They're wildflowers,
huh? Yeah. And I don't think we have a whole lot of goldenrod here. I see something that maybe is it once in a while, but I see more of what you're talking about, the little yellow flowers. And, you know, I was always a little prejudiced against yellow flowers because they seem so common to me. And so in my garden, flower gardens I've had over the years, the yellow flowers always thrive where other flowers don't.
Mm-hmm. Interesting, isn't it?
Yeah.
I love that. Yellow was one of my very favorite colors. I have a little yellow tote bag from the Museum of Modern Art that has a quote from Pierre Bonnard on it that is, one cannot have too much yellow. And I firmly believe that. It always cheers me up to see it. So, yeah.
Yeah, I've come to actually grow quite fond of yellow. And I just got back from a business trip to Mexico, and there were I saw a couple flower stands and fields of sunflowers that were stunning. Stunning. And I'm like, I love sunflowers. And I didn't actually realize how much I love sunflowers. And I've never grown them. But I think I might plant some next year.
I love that.
Yeah. So you're listening to Writer's Voices, and our guest today is Maggie Smith, and her collection of poems is titled Goldenrod. Maggie, you talked about how you go through all the poems that you've brought together. How did you say it? Something like you've gathered to be in conversation in this book. So that's what I want to ask you about, is how do you select the poems to put in a collection? And I'm guessing that for every poem you put in, you have one or two or 10 that don't make the cut.
That's absolutely right. I think when I was putting together the first draft of Goldenrod, I packed about 120 poems in a suitcase to Tucson, where I was a writer in residence at the time. And I started going through all of these poems just in a big stack, and putting some aside that just didn't feel organic to the whole, like those feel different to me. They don't feel like they want to live and play nicely between two covers with the rest of these rascals. And so really it's kind of flipping through, looking at the poems, thinking about which ones I'm most excited about, and then looking at the ways that they are in conversation, because I really don't write a book of poems as a book. I write one poem at a time. And I don't write every day, so I might write a poem one week and then not write a poem. And then the next month, maybe one or two more show up. And so it really does take 5, 6, 7 years for me to write a book of poems, because they have to accrue naturally over time. I can't rush that process. So printing everything out at the end is one of the magical moments for me, because then I get to see what I've been building all along and had no idea. Like, I've just been doing this tiny little, you know, painting one corner of a canvas and then moving and painting another little piece of it. But I've been so close, I haven't had a chance to kind of step back from it and see what it actually is that I've been painting all along. And so when I started putting together these poems, I thought, oh, well, look, there are all of these wildflowers are showing up, and all of these birds and these trees and my kids and these big questions about faith and doubt and change and transition. And wow, there's a lot of architecture in these poems, and a lot of poems that have the moon in them. And so getting to see those echoes and see how they're actually wanting to sort of live together in a whole, it's pretty intuitive, but I just sort of start stacking them and seeing how they work, read aloud one after the other, and they tend to kind of tell me if they want to be in the same space or if they need to be kind of partitioned off and saved for maybe the next book or the next book.
So does that happen sometimes?
Oh, it absolutely does. I mean, there are poems in my second book, for example, that came out in 2015 that I wrote in the late 90s. And I just didn't think they fit in the book that was published 10 years earlier. They weren't ready for that book. But when I was putting together the next collection, I thought, oh, remember those guys I left out of that first book? They fit perfectly with these. And so just because they get sort of sidelined or benched in the moment doesn't mean they're not going to get called up to play. It just means they're not quite right for that particular team at that time.
Ah. So, Maggie, how did you become a poet?
That's a good question. I think sometimes people don't actually become poets. They just realize they are one. And I think I realized I was a poet when I was a teenager, mostly listening to my parents' records and getting really hooked on the metaphors and images in songs by, you know, Neil Young and the Beatles and Joni Mitchell, and just loving really well-written, imagistic, metaphor-based songs, and just starting to see the world that way, you know, just walking and being like, oh, those clouds look like this, or the sound that bird makes sounds kind of like a typewriter key being pressed over and over again, or that flower looks like X or like Y. And so I think I just realized that's how I process things, regardless of whether I ever wrote any of it down. It's the way I see and think. And I don't know that that is really something that's taught. I think for me, it feels really natural. It's like parenting to me. It's one of the things that feels most natural to me as a human being is making poems.
And yet taking the step from that to being a professional poet is not something everybody would do.
No, and nor something I thought I would do, to be quite honest. I mean, you know, when I was in college and I was a creative writing and women's studies major with a philosophy minor, no one really knew what I would do to pay my bills as an adult. I never knew if I would be able to make a living as a writer. I just knew it was something I would always do. And I feel very fortunate that through, you know, editing and teaching and traveling for, you know, keynotes and readings and workshops and writing, that I've been able to sort of carve out a life in poetry. But it's not a path I really saw coming, and it's not necessarily an easy path.
I would say it's definitely not an easy path. It's a challenging path for sure, because it's not like there's a lot of job listings
for poets.
For poets,
yes, there aren't. I mean, most of the people I know who are poets, you know, teach in universities, or work in publishing, or some of them are doctors, or they sell insurance, or they work in retail. I mean, we all have to do other things, because poems themselves are not, that's not really a lucrative endeavor, writing poems. So we sort of cobble it together the best we can. And for me, it's been really beautiful. I think what I've given up in sort of job security, I've gained in time and in flexibility. And as a parent, that's been one of the biggest gifts, particularly noticeable over the past year and a half, as I've got kids, you know, zooming school from my house and really needing to be very available. Having a schedule I can kind of make for myself has been a real blessing for them too.
Oh yes, indeed.
Now, yeah. Your children feature pretty heavily in your poetry. How do they feel about that?
Well, so far they think it's pretty cool.
They aren't teenagers yet, huh?
Well, I've got one who's in middle school, but still finds it pretty cool. You know, it's just my job. I don't know that – I think, you know, I've been a poet their whole lives. So I think – if you grow up with a parent who's a poet, it's not that unlike, you know, me having a parent who works for the phone company. It's just that's what they do. So I don't think it really, you know, maybe if I'd started doing this halfway through their lives or something, it would seem kind of odd, but it's just sort of always been the way that things are. And pre-COVID, they were able to come to readings at bookstores and come to book launches and sit in the front row and hear as I read poems that maybe referenced a question that they'd asked, or had a little snippet of their dialogue, or, you know, recounted a day at the park that we had together and would smile about it. So So now that we're Zooming and everything, they're not really present for most of it anymore, but they know it's happening.
Are you ever hesitant to, I mean, are there times where you think, well, I can't write that. It's too personal to them.
I haven't really had that in poetry yet. You know, there have been essays I've written where I've held things back because I just don't think that's my story to tell. It's someone else's story.
Mm-hmm.
But no, I mean, I just have to trust myself, not only with my kids, but with, you know, my friends, my mom, my sisters, everyone, really. I mean, if you're a writer, you are very, and you write about your life, you are very used to considering these issues of sort of disclosure and privacy all the time. It's just a balance.
Right. And even if you're not writing about your life, there have been some sort of big literary, not scandals exactly, but disputes lately about how much can you borrow of somebody's life to fill out your character without crossing the line.
Oh, I have seen that. I don't envy the fiction writers that problem at all. I feel very glad to at least have the neatness of knowing I'm speaking about myself. And I was like, I was there, so I know how I can describe it.
I know. I feel sometimes I think it's a little bit of a mountain out of a molehill because we're always, you know, when you're writing fiction, you're always taking things from real life, from other people's lives, as well as your own. And, you know, I think that's been happening as long as people have been writing books.
Oh, yes, I agree. I mean, I think we have to be very careful not to co-opt other people's experience for our own art. But I think it is a fine line. And
yeah.
I think most of us are walking that line pretty carefully, and some of us tip over a little bit more than we perhaps should, and then that's what lands you in hot water on Twitter, for example.
Yes. So Maggie, why don't you read us another poem?
Sure, I'd be happy to. Let me see. Okay, this is called At the End of Our Marriage in the Backyard, speaking of lawns that one wishes not to mow. That's how I feel about mine. At the end of our marriage in the backyard, we let the lawn go to wild violets and dandelions, to crabgrass, to clover bending under the weight of so many honeybees, our children can't run barefoot. We do nothing, letting ivy snarl around the downspouts and air conditioner, letting milkweed grow and float its white feathers. We do nothing and call it something, as if this wilding were intentional. If there is honey, I tell myself, we are to thank. All summer, the children must wear shoes. We sit out back while they crouch in the clover, watching the bees calling out when they see sunny crumbs of pollen on their legs. Maybe no one will be stung. Late in the season, we sit ankle deep in weeds and flowers, in weeds we call flowers.
And that was Maggie Smith reading from Goldenrod. Mom, do you have some questions or comments from your reading of this book?
Yes, I do. The thing I like about poetry, and this one, this your poetry in particular, Maggie, is you read a poem and you get a feeling from it or something from it, and then you go on, and then you come back and you read it again, and you get something different. That's what I enjoy the most.
Because thank you for that.
Yeah, you have so many, you have a real talent, you really do, because I've always liked poetry and wish I could do better at writing it, but that's what I really enjoyed about your poem. There's so much in there, in each one of them, the half staff was good, I thought. First thaw, tender age is something. I wish you would read that one for us.
I would be happy to read that one.
That's page page 51.
51, thank you. Now, I have a friend I had dinner with last night who said that she does something now, which she picks on the first of the month, she picks a poem, a single poem, and she reads it every morning aloud, every day that month. And the poem every day is completely new to her.
Mm-hmm.
And I love that. It reminds me a lot of what you just said.
Yeah.
Okay. So this is Tender Age. It's one of the longer poems in the book. It's not too long. I tend not to write very long poems. And it has a couple of bracketed sections because it's based on a recording here at the beginning. So I'll just read the brackets. Tender Age. America, I've heard the audio. Papa, 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 bracket, unintelligible, bracket, inconsolable crying. America, my childhood neighborhood was called Freedom Colony. I lived on Liberty Lane. America, you are grand in theory, poor in practice. You are not what I learned in grade school. America, I'm proofreading a book on your Constitution. I'm considering the letter of the law, the spirit of the law. America, you've caged even the babies. They cry mostly in Spanish. America, this is you. America, what I miss most about church are the hymns. Everyone singing the same word at the same time. Even the bells rang in unison. America, I'm wondering who your laws serve, the living or the dead. America, are there cribs for the babies, bars within bars? America, where does your conscience live? I mean, from where has it been removed? America, as a girl, I rode my bike around the cul-de-sacs, Lexington, Bunker Hill, Valley Forge. America, I can pick the stars and peel the stripes right off you. America, I'm considering the letter, the spirit. America, there is no substitute for conscience. I can still feel the bells in my hands. America, this is us. America, we have taken children from their mothers. We have separated words from their meanings. America, will there be neighborhoods named for this undeclared war? America, where are the babies? America, when we want to silence the bells, we extinguish their open mouths on our chests.
And that was Maggie Smith reading from Goldenrod. There's really not much I can say to that.
It's a hard poem.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a hard poem.
It's a hard reality.
It's a hard reality. That's right. That's right. I mean, my poems are really the stuff of life. So there are a lot of walking the dog and a lot of being in the backyard or having conversations with my kids. But the stuff of the last several years writing this book was also the stuff of, you know, my kids having lockdown drills at their elementary schools and trying to explain these policies to them and trying to explain police brutality to them. And it's been, you know, years of really difficult conversations as a parent.
Yeah, I've, you know, look back on my own parenting years because I have grandchildren now and I'm thinking things have really gotten tougher. When COVID started, I was with my grandkids who were, 7 and 10 then, because they're 8 and 11 mm-hmm. now. And I was explaining to them, I said, you know, it seems like in every generation there is some significant event that kind of changes the world for your generation and going forward. And this is it. This is yours. And I said, you know, 20 years ago it was 9/11. And they're like, well, what's that? Because they didn't, especially the little one. The older one had heard of it kind of, but the little one hadn't. And And I showed them the video of the towers falling, and then I thought maybe I shouldn't do that because it's so scary. But I said, you know, that was a long time ago. But there often is something really significant like that.
Yeah.
For you, Mom, it would have been World War II.
Right.
Yeah.
Yep. And our kids, I think, have had several in a very short span of time. It just seems like there are so many sort of once in a lifetime, quote unquote, once in a lifetime, or defining moments. It seems like they're kind of piling up so that the term once in a lifetime means very little.
Yeah.
Even with, you know, climate change and what they're witnessing in that regard. It has been just a real pile up in the past few years of,
yeah, the hundred year floods that happen every few years.
Exactly. Yeah, the once in a lifetime pandemic, the 100-year flood that happens, multiple times, the fires. It really has been a sort of pile up, and it's difficult to deal with this in conversation and difficult to deal with this in poetry, but I feel a responsibility to deal with it in both ways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, in Goldenrod, you have the poems are in three different sections. Is there a particular meaning in how they're separated that way?
You know, it's largely intuitive. I mean, there are 18 poems per section, which is sort of a lucky number for me because my kids' birthdays are both on the 18th. But it's mostly that I think of sort of like the white space between stanzas in a poem, or the white space at the end of a page before you go to the next page in the next poem. I like that white space because I think it gives the reader a little time to kind of regroup before they move on to something else. It's sort of a doorway. And I like having sections in a book for that same reason. It kind of gives you a little bit of a pause and a regroup before entering into a slightly different space. So the poems are grouped together pretty intuitively. You know, when I read the end of a poem, I think, okay, so what poem naturally follows this one, either imagistically or tonally? What feels right after this particular poem? And so I tend to build a book one poem at a time, thinking about the transitions from poem to poem. And then I go through later and think about how I might want to divide it up section-wise.
Now, do you have a lot of poems that you haven't published yet?
Yes. Yeah, many more than I have published. For every poem that makes it, there are several that are sort of waiting on the sidelines with their fingers crossed, hoping they get the wink and the wave forward. So yes, there are lots of poems I haven't published. Some of them I just don't feel like are done yet. Some of them have been published in journals or magazines, but haven't been collected into a book yet because they just, like I was saying before, haven't found their way into a whole just yet. So we'll see. We'll see. I have hope for those guys. They'll find their way eventually.
Well, how do you know when a poem is done, when it's finished?
Oh, that's so tricky. Sometimes I think I know, and I send it out to a friend, and they say, oh, yeah, that's done. Or, have you thought about this, this, and this? Sometimes I think it's done, and I send it to a magazine, and the magazine thinks it's done, and they publish it. And then a few years later, when I'm trying to collect poems in a book, I find that one. I still like it, but I'd change a few things if I could, and I do.
So because you can.
Sometimes the poem changes. Because I can, because it's mine. So sometimes a poem actually even changes from first publication in a journal, in a literary journal, and book publication. Every once in a while, something will kind of shift because I've had some change of heart, or I've grown in the craft, or just something has occurred to me. But usually I know when a poem is done when I don't feel the need to fuss with it anymore.
Mm.
And there is no sort of neat answer to that. I look at it, I read it aloud, I spend more time with it. I try a bunch of different things, and then I feel satisfied. And it takes me a lot to feel satisfied with a poem. So when I finally feel satisfied, that's when I know it's doing the work it came to do, and I can let it go and work on something else.
How long do you spend on a typical poem?
Sometimes months, sometimes years, sometimes hours. It really depends. I mean, I've had some poems happen really quickly. Good Bones was one of them. I think I wrote that poem in less than a half an hour, which is really strange, because if I had known how many people would read that poem, I probably wouldn't have ever finished it, because it never would have been ready for that many eyes.
Is there anything about it you would change if you could?
Not a thing. No, actually, no. I wouldn't change a thing. I think it just is. It is itself. But there are poems in Goldenrod. The poem for my next trick is an example, and even Half Staff, that I began writing years and years ago and just couldn't get there. There was a gap between the poem I was writing and the poem I knew it could be, and it just needed time. It needed to steep like tea. time never made anything any worse as far as a piece of writing is concerned. So if I'm not feeling like it's done, the best thing I can do for a piece of writing is just put it down and trust future me to know better what to do with it. And future me might be me in 3 days, or me in 3 weeks, or me in 6 months. But oftentimes, if I set something aside and then come back to it, something will click, and I'll see what it needs that I couldn't see before.
So how many poems would you have sort of in process at any one time?
Oh, dozens and dozens and dozens.
Oh, my.
Yeah, I have lots and lots and lots and lots of half-written poems.
So how do you decide what to work on today?
That's a good question. I mean, usually if I don't have a new idea, but I have time, and that happens a lot, I'm just not feeling, I don't have anything new cooking in my brain, but I have an hour to write. I'll go into my little folder on my laptop of new poems. It's not very well organized. It's all just alphabetical. And I'll open a document and I'll look at it. And if I notice anything that I feel like expanding on or fixing or doing something with it, if it sparks something in me, I'll work on that for a while. And if not, I just close it and I scroll through and I pick something else. It's completely random. So they might get started and then sit in there kind of half done for months, maybe even years, before I get around to them again. And then they're just really hoping that I know what I'm doing when I finally open that document. And sometimes I don't, and they have to sit a while longer.
Wow. Well, let's have you read another poem.
Sure. I'm just going to flip here to the back. Oh, so this is the latest poems in Goldenrod were written during the pandemic, late in 2020. And this is one of them. It's called "During Lockdown, I Let the Dog Sleep in My Bed Again." And the dog was actually in earlier drafts of this poem, and I edited the dog out of the poem, but I left her in the title. During lockdown, I let the dog sleep in my bed again. Last night, my daughter cried at bedtime of loneliness, she said. She's seen the grass, the jagged mountain we need to press into a meadow, and maybe she pictures the drive home from southern Ohio. How the green hills flatten without us doing a damn thing, no sacrifice required. I tell her the steep peak makes loneliness our work, makes an honorable task of it. But I shut myself in the bathroom and cry hard into a hand towel. I walk alone in the snow, squinting up into the big wet flakes, letting them bathe my face. I tell myself, it is a kind of touch. I tell myself it will do.
And once again, that was Maggie Smith reading from her new book, Goldenrod. Now, there are three poems in here that are one in each section, I think, called Ohio Cento. Can you tell me what that means?
Yeah, so cento, or to speak proper Italian, it would be a cento.
Cento.
A cento is an Italian form. I say cento because I also say croissant, you know, because I'm from Ohio. I say cento. So a cento is an Italian form that is basically word collage. So all of the lines in these poems are not mine. They're all called Ohio cento because each line from these three poems was pulled from a poem by another Ohio poet. So either a poet born in the state of Ohio or currently living here. I myself am both. I was born here and I am currently living here. So all of the poem itself is assembled from other people's lines, and the job is really making a new whole based on these sentences. And so it's actually a terrific form to work in if you have a little bit of writer's block, because if you don't have any sort of ideas of your own at the moment, you can go to your bookshelf, if you're like me and you have a bookshelf full of books of poems, and pull down a few books, pull a line out of a poem and write it down, and then look at how it ends and think, oh, it ends with a noun. So I could find a prepositional phrase beginning line, or a line that begins with a verb phrase, and go into another poem by that same poet or another book and find a line that would make sense completing perhaps that sentence. And then you sort of build from there. And it's actually great fun and a wonderful challenge.
Now, does it have to be entire lines, or can you have segments of lines?
So I have, classically it's an entire line, okay. Not an entire sentence, but an entire line.
Right.
So any of these poems, each line comes from a different poet. So a single sentence might be from one poet if it takes up one line, or it might be from several different poets. But that's the sort of measurement for a cento. And of course, forms are made to be changed and distorted and broken and reimagined. So one could really do it however they want, but this is how I've done mine.
It's so interesting. That seems like a kind of a fun thing. It's almost like a puzzle.
It is. And I mean, you know, really you could pull, if you look at the poems, you know, you could pull one line and see how I could have chosen a different line later and made a sentence, because it really is collage. It's sort of, one could cut up poems and sort of physically move them around on the page and make new work based on, and there's a long tradition for doing that in literature. And so the cento is just one way of doing that.
It's kind of like those refrigerator magnets that are words, and you can move them around and create different sentences and they're really fun.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Except you get, we have the benefit of this. I have the benefit of going into terrific work by poets I really admire and getting to borrow some of their wonderful languages and, you know, wonderful phrases and images, some of their terrific language to build a poem of my own.
So Caroline, when you were teaching English, did you ever have your students do anything like that?
No, but that would have been interesting.
Yeah, it would.
I was wondering, Maggie, did you ever try haiku poetry?
I have. And in fact, I went through a period where I was writing poems in haiku stanzas. So instead of just an individual haiku, I was writing poems that had the 575 syllable count in each stanza. Oh. So it was sort of building haikus. So yes, I love working in form, actually. I love working in received forms and sometimes kind of changing it up and changing the rules for myself. But I find that constraint actually really freeing, that sometimes when given a received form, it requires us to be creative and sort of think outside the box in other ways, because the form is a constant.
Hmm. We are almost out of time, but I do want to mention that your work has also received some extra attention recently because our First Lady read it at an event.
So she did.
Yeah. So what was that? And how did that come about?
I'm not quite sure how it came about, but a friend of mine reached out and said, do you know that Dr. Jill Biden just quoted you in her opening remarks for the American Ballet Theater's summer, you know, and I thought, no, I did not know that. And she sent a video, which I had to watch several times to believe that that was actually my name coming out of her mouth. And she quoted a one of the poems in my book, Good Bones. And I'm not quite sure how she came across the poem, but what an honor. And I, you know, whenever I have to say, like, it meant a lot to me personally also just to feel, you know, she was introducing ballet performance and just feeling the support of the administration and feeling their support of the arts in general. It felt, you know, particularly meaningful to me. So it meant a lot, and I was completely flabbergasted.
I bet. That's wonderful. I was going to ask on the cento, when you're borrowing these lines, do you have to get permission, or are they short enough that it doesn't violate any copyright?
These are short enough that it doesn't violate copyright, but I have acknowledged them in the back. So in the credits, there is a list of all of the poets whose lines I've borrowed to make these poems, because it really is, I mean, this project in itself, I've written many of Ohio Centos, only three are in this book, but there are others. And it was such a labor of love and really an homage to my literary roots as someone who's a lifelong resident of Ohio. And there's been so many terrific writers to come out of this state. I really wanted to undertake that as a project. So it was, I feel very lucky to have gotten to borrow some of their words for those.
Well, Maggie, we're out of time, and I just want to tell our listeners that if you like poetry, you will love Goldenrod. If you're not sure about poetry, you'll still love Goldenrod.
Like oh, thank you.
And Mom, do you have some closing words for us today?
Well, of course, I have that quote that I always use: a poem should not mean but be. And that fits this book perfectly.
Well, thank you, Maggie, so much for being with us today.
Oh, no, thank you. This was a pleasure. I hope to get to have conversations like this with my own daughter many, many years in the future about poems. So this was a joy.
I hope so, too. And see you all next week on Writer's Voices.